Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. And boy, do I have a story to tell you today. This is something that makes me very happy. My guest is Jonathan Blum. His book, a novella, is called Last Word. And I guess my story begins in a bakery where a gentleman came up to me and said, "Are you Michael Silverblatt?" And I said, "I am." And he said, "We're a huge fan of your show, but my nephew is an even bigger fan of your show, and he's a writer, and he's going to be publishing his first book." I said, "Sit down, you know, welcome. Would you be sure that he sends it to me?" And, you know, it is the case that the more welcoming you are, the less likely it is that you'll get the book. I don't know why. I don't know why. But Uncle Stephen, I said?
Yep.
Must have been persuasive because Jonathan Blum sent me Last Word. I read it as soon as I got it. Not sure why. There was something that seemed fated about my relation to this book, and I loved it. I read it all night long, couldn't stop reading it, and when it was finished, I knew that I wanted to talk about it on my show for so many different reasons, not all of which I knew. Well, it turns out, where did Jonathan take his first literature classes?
At Santa Monica College, yeah. And I think it was 1987, fall of 1987. I wasn't really sure if I wanted to be in school or not, but I took a couple classes at Santa Monica College, and one of them was a post-war literature class, fiction and poetry. And during that class, I read writers that I had never heard of, never read before, including Carver, Cheever, Tim O'Brien, Flannery O'Connor, Bernard Malamud, and on and on. And I knew just in that one class that what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And I guess I signed on the bottom line, and I've, you know, that's been my life ever since. So, yeah, I feel a lot of indebtedness towards Santa Monica College.
And while a student, you heard a certain radio show.
Yes, yes.
And it convinced you that there was a way of life connected to this reading. What show was that?
Yeah, I mean, I remember seeing Carver read at Beyond Baroque in 1988, and I remember, you know, seeing Ann Beatty for the first time or Mona Simpson for the first time, and they were writing stuff that I was really interested in. And to see that actual live people were doing this, it was illuminating.
And so I thought, wow, a member of our community, not just our L.A. community, but our Santa Monica College community and our KCRW community has written a novella, and it's terrific. This is a book that I'm sure is going to win this debut writer, I think, enormous recognition and certainly a readership. And I wanted to begin by letting you know something of the tone. So I'm going to ask him to read the first couple of paragraphs to his first book, the novella Last Word, from Rescue Press.
Last Word. If I learn computers, like my wife Andy tells me to, really learn them, I'd have more in common with the boy I know, and all this might not have happened. But that's just it. I shouldn't have to learn computers to have a relationship with my 13-year-old son. On the contrary, I am now going to have to keep the boy away from the computer. I am proud of his intelligence, of course, and of how he has apparently mastered certain techniques which, I am told, if applied legitimately, might one day lead to a high-paying and respected job. But there's a lot computers can't teach you about discipline and decency and how to relate normally to other people. That's why Andy and I have always offered Eric and his half-sisters, in addition to a Jewish education, a choice of healthy, positive activities. Swimming, I've often said, would be a good activity for Eric. I like swimming. You can do it competitively, which builds character, and yet it's not an activity that involves rough physical contact with others, which I know Eric dislikes. You can swim your whole life. Swimming would also help trim some of the fat rolls off Eric's middle, which, if he didn't spend so much time at the computer, he could also accomplish by jogging or exercise at a gym. Eric's half-sisters, Renata and Mina, swim and have plenty of time to mess around on the computer. They do well in school. Neither girl is overweight. That said, now that Eric has been expelled from Troutman V. Goldfarb K-8 Day School Academy, and now that he's been placed on the 100 online haters beware list by the Southeast Regional Office of the nation's second leading anti-intolerance watchdog group, and seeing as the Shoshana Kalstein Ken Mosher civil liability situation appears only to be getting worse, I have had to do a little soul searching. What do these computer stunts of Eric's mean? Has he been trying to attract my attention in a negative attention kind of way? Is this what he thinks it takes to be cool within his peer group? Is he simply copycatting what boys with computers all over the country do nowadays, starting right after their bar mitzvahs? No matter the ifs, ands, or buts, it's not going to be funny, ha-ha, look what I can get away with, you people, when Eric winds up in prison next time, like the computer madmen whose mugshots you see on CNN. Some of the blame, personal, not legal, I must accept. Parents err. We misjudge risk, under-exercise our influence. We don't always know how to get through to our children. Yet even factoring in my shortcomings, things do not add up. Why choose the path where no good can come of taking it? Why push mischief to the extreme? This is not something Eric learned from Andy, and it is not something he learned from me. Sadly, I have begun to fear that Eric's behavior in the past few months may in fact be a destructive trait in his mother, alive in South Florida, now pronouncing itself in him. And I would like to do something while it's still early, maybe send him to an adolescent psych specialist or sit him down with a values clarification coach. But Eric, I think, would resist those suggestions, and Andy says I shouldn't speak negatively of Eric's mother, and so I keep these sorts of thoughts to myself.
That was Jonathan Blum reading from Last Word. Now tell me, this seems to me to be such an inevitable subject right now. This child that gets in trouble on the computer, and the parents who are a bit bewildered because they wouldn't be able to get into that trouble if they wanted to.
Right.
But what we hear from this father, whose name is Kip, if I remember correctly, is that in his tone toward his son and his rolls of fat, this father is creating some of the sadness and tension that is erupting in the form of the computer madness.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of there's a lot of comedy and a lot of sadness when you have characters who are behaving a certain way, speaking a certain way, doing certain things, and the awareness that they have of themselves and what they're doing is different from the reader's awareness of what they're doing. And that tension is really important to me, and it was very important in writing this story. I think the first writer that I really noticed doing this well was Cervantes in the Quixote, where, you know, Don Quixote's understanding of himself and Sancho and all of the people that he meets is one thing. And then your understanding of what Quixote is doing is something quite different. And I was interested in that idea when I was working on this story, because I think that the narrator, Kip, lacks a lot of understanding of what he's doing, but we, the reader, have more understanding of it. I knew that the story would have a certain impact if the father was narrating it and he did not have access to the son's thoughts, that would mean that the reader doesn't have access to the son's thoughts. The reader has access to what the character says and what the character does and what other people say about him and so on. But we never really get entry into Eric's thoughts. And so that ends up being a central mystery in the story. And I think that there's a lot of power in that kind of mystery. And also I think it's true. I mean, we don't have access to so many people's thoughts that we wish we did. And if he is angry and if he is vengeful and if he were going to enact all of his sort of thoughts and fantasies, that would be really dangerous. We feel that about him. But again, we don't have access to his thoughts. And anyway, for me, that a lot of the power that I wanted the story to have came from that.
And its universality too, because it seems to me, how often does it happen that we know what our children are thinking? I don't even know what my cat is thinking most of the time. I'm talking to Jonathan Blum about his very first book, his debut novella, and I feel, however ridiculous and this may sound, I feel we can all feel proud of this. This is a man who comes from our community, who started his study of writing at Santa Monica College, who quickly found Bookworm as a companion to listen to, and who has been writing for how many years now?
More than, seriously, for maybe 25.
Yeah. And just got his first book accepted and published. So that there is a message, what? Tenacity, mm-hmm. to believing in the dream. I know that's crazy, believing in the dream. And when I read the book, I wanted it on my show. I didn't know anything about Santa Monica College, Bookworm fan. I just knew it was a really good book. Now, the next part of this wonderful story is Jonathan Blum writes a novella. As I understand it, it was completed 6 years ago.
It was completed more than 6 years ago. And it didn't find a home. It was not accepted for publication many times. And at some point, I just stopped trying to get it published because I didn't really know what else to do. And so I had it probably on my hard drive for 6 years, and I went on and wrote other things. And then I was at a faculty reading. I teach during the summers at the Iowa Summer Writing Festival, and they have a faculty reading every year. And I decided to read the first couple paragraphs of Last Word, exactly what I read here. And Carol Pagel of Rescue Press was there. She heard the first couple paragraphs. She asked if she could read the whole thing. I was delighted at her interest, and I gave her the novella. She read it. And then Daniel Colacci, the other editor at Rescue Press, read it. They loved it and wanted to publish it immediately. And I mean, I was so thrilled. It's inexpressible how happy I was to hear that. And I loved the way they spoke about it. I could tell that they had an understanding of it, a feeling for it. And I mean, it just fell beautifully into place, really. I mean, all of their editorial suggestions were helpful to me. I took many of them when we were editing the book. They let me have some say over the cover, over the design, over the copy editing. It was a real collaboration. And, you know, both of them are very fine writers in their own right. And I liked very much that they're based in Iowa City, which is a special book-loving place.
Yes. One of the marvelous things is it's a success story. My guest is Jonathan Blum. His novella is Last Word. It's a story narrated by a father whose, can I say it, bad habits show up in his son. Everything is under the umbrella of Jewish values and the values and respect for others, which, as it happens, at best, people have only frailly. In the day school where this is occurring, I mean, there are easy solutions. There always are. And of course, the day school could have changed the computer program right away, and this would have ended there and then. But people love problems, and so do stories.
Yeah.
Stories love to simmer.
Yeah.
And what we watch is a whole community take fire, as they always do. What we see in this novella is the imaginative consequences of realistic propositions, possibilities. In other words, they say about fiction is you start it and then you let the worst that can happen happen. Okay. How do you do that as a writer, to condemn the characters to their worst behaviors?
Well, for me, the key to that is not positioning yourself above the characters. This was something that I've been aware of for a long time. I don't really love most writing where the writer positions himself above the characters and is sort of heavily satirical in method. I would like to think that I see myself as being as fallible and as prone to error as my characters are. And a lot of people hurt each other in this story in different ways. And I feel guilty myself for having hurt people in my life. And I feel like I've tried to make good on it. I mean, one thing that, you know, the narrator of the story wants to do is to bring the son to apologize to someone that the son has hurt. And I mean, there's so many reasons why people hurt each other and continue to hurt each other, and the stakes keep getting higher and higher. Anyway, that was something I wanted to explore in the story.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Jonathan Blum about his book, Last Word, from Rescue Press. We'll continue after this short break.
This is Connie Alvarez. Bookworm is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station in Los Angeles. It costs money to put this program together. Please help support us by going to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Jonathan Blum about his debut, Last Word, when the age-old story of the conflicted father-son relationship crashes into modern parenting and online culture. Well, there's a lot to be said, including that this father, he seems to be unable to help it. He is so riddled with guilt that he's constantly saying things like, "Oh, I understand it. I cheated my way through med school." It's exactly the wrong thing to be saying at that moment. At that moment, he should be displaying parental virtue, even if it's impossible, you know. Or when learning that his son expelled from the world of private school is now going to a public school and says that he wants to learn Italian, and the son says, and the father says, "Bet you want to meet girls." It's such a crazy thing to say. He's always quite off the mark, and the son has reached the point that he growls at the father. He says, idiot.
Or and I hate you.
I hate you.
Yeah.
The son so badly needs someone, well, to be honest, like the writer Jonathan Blum, who could reach in compassionately and offer a statement of consolation and rescue. I guess rescue is the subject here.
Yeah.
But there is no such person in the story.
It's true. It's true, there isn't. The head of the Iowa Summer Writing Festival, Amy Margolis, called Eric that he's a diaspora within a diaspora. I thought that was pretty brilliant. Yeah, he doesn't have anyone in the book that he connects with. Everyone that he might connect with, he doesn't.
Well, it's also the way in which a Jewish education is frequently, perhaps incorrectly, shaped. That children are being taught that they've been historically victims. And now, in the new aggressive dominant culture, they say, victims no more. Let the accused accuse. And they say, well, you've all sat still while the history of the Jews has been to be kicked around the world, and yet you're teaching us not to be kicked around. Well, which is it?
Yeah.
And this boy, this Eric, has an incredibly, to my mind, disturbing view of the problem.
Yeah.
He points out that in the Bible, there are cases where the Jews have been persecuted, and when they've eliminated the persecutor, they've gone on to further murder potential schemers against them. And he thinks it's the right thing to do because he's in the Hebrew Academy where this has been taught to him. Now, here we enter the real issue, morality versus religious morality. And can fiction even address it? I would say that this kind of fiction has to.
There's a part of me that wanted to give Eric a gun, like a writer part of me. I would have had to write a very different story, and it would have had different consequences and ramifications. But I thought a lot about Eric's character and how if he had a gun, I could do all sorts of different things. And what I ended up doing at the end of the story is I tried to leave things off where you could imagine him being angry enough to really hurt someone and himself. And I didn't want to enact that dramatically. I just wanted it to sort of be part of the inferable future of the story.
Yes, and I think that one of the interesting things about this story, about Last Word by my guest Jonathan Blum, is that the story begins before its first page and, more interestingly, continues after its last page. Throughout this novella, we've been seeing little councils and groups of judges and parents meeting together to decide what is to be done, expulsion, suspension, public apology, all of these things. And then at the end of the book, when we finally get from Eric's voice, you know, because he's been speaking in silence or computerese, but finally in the last pages, he says a few things. And now it's time for the reader to be the judge. The process of judgment is going to take place after you close the book. And I think that's a very brilliant strategy for this book. Many readers say, well, I want to know what happens. I want to know exactly what happens. And I would say in this book, you do know what happens. What you don't know is what you think about what happens and what you would do in these shoes.
Yeah.
And I think that is a very interesting moral position for a writer to put a reader in. Do you identify with that idea?
Completely, completely. I'm not sure what to add to that. I mean, I thought that was very eloquently stated.
Well, thank you, but that's my job, and I'm interested.
Well, we all know you excel at your job.
I'm interested. Well, but you see, you do it yours. So I'm, you know, I feel like I'm talking to a young writer, first book, but no longer young, yeah. A writer with a lot of experience.
Yeah.
I've read some of the other stories you've published, and I like them very much. And I feel that you've thought about the narrative complications of bad behavior.
Yeah. I think that for many Jewish people, or at least for this Jewish person, like Jewish aggression, like the desire to dominate, like just the desire to have the last word. One of the reasons that I called this book Last Word, at some point while I was writing it, it occurred to me that no one ever gets the last word. Having the last word is an illusion. And you might think at a given moment that you have gotten the last word, but you don't. Somebody else will take the next word, or at some point you'll die and people will say whatever they say about you and you won't be able to add anything to it. So there is no such thing as a last word. And yet the characters in this book, and Eric certainly among them, would like to have the last word. I mean, they're clamoring for it. And nobody gets the last word in this story. I mean, as you said, Michael, the reader gets the last word of imagining whatever the inferable future of the story is. But in the human world, yeah, I mean, the last word is an illusion.
I've been talking with Jonathan Blum, author most recently of Last Word, published by Rescue Press. Thank you, Jonathan, for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Robert Dewhurst has acted as a co-producer on today's show. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Jaime Hernandez and Juno Diaz are our guests.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.